You know, a very important thing that we need to do, Bill Mariu, as well as communicate with all of you, is to bring all of you to the people that work behind the scenes. And the people that work in manufacturing, the people that make the blood culture bottles. And this video was really developed to show them the importance of what they do. So we wanted to share that with you to, you know, show that we're trying to bring you internally as well, because it means a lot to them when they're in there every day working on a manufacturing line or in quality or wherever, to know where does that blood culture bottle go? You know, what happens, that there's actually a patient at the end of the line. So we wanted to share that with you. Our next speaker this morning is Dr. Cynthia Fowler, the Senior Medical Director, Global Medical Affairs at bioMérieux. Cynthia Fowler is a physician specializing in infectious diseases and clinical microbiology. She provides medical advice and expertise to multiple departments, senior management at bioMérieux. She also represents the company in scientific and medical forums such as CLSI, ASM, IDSA, and ESCMID. Prior to joining bioMérieux in 2005, she worked in the pharmaceutical industry for 14 years. During this time, she was involved in clinical research on several types of drugs: antibacterial, antiviral, and antifungal, and was instrumental in the registration of Levaquin, and what we all know as levofloxacin. Dr. Fowler has a BA in microbiology from the University of Texas. She graduated from Southwestern Medical School, did her postgraduate medical training in internal medicine and infectious diseases at the University of New Mexico and the University of Maryland. She completed a fellowship in clinical microbiology at the National Institute of Health. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Fowler as she presents the impact of microbiology results, a physician's perspective.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me? Brian? Can you hear me now? Great. Michelle, thank you very much for that very nice introduction. So you now all know who I am, and I would like to know who you are. If I could just see, please, how many of you are microbiologists working in a lab at a bench? Thank you. How many of you are senior level supervisors or PhD? How many of you are physicians? Pharmacists? Great. Thank you very much. Now I know who you are. Well, I appreciate being asked to give this talk. When they gave me the topic, I went, oh my gosh, that is a really big topic. So I decided to narrow it down a little bit, and I'm going to talk about the impact of IDAST. And I further narrowed it down to bacteria and fungi. So I'm not really going to talk about viruses. Some of the slides on your handout are out of order, and I've added some new ones. And I'm really sorry about that, because I know it's annoying. And if, as I go through the talk, there are slides that you absolutely have to have, please contact your bioMérieux rep. They will track me down, and they will send you a copy. So I've already told you who I am, or Michelle has. And today, really what I'm going to do is, this is such a big topic. This is not going to be one of those nice linear talks that just sort of flows from one point to another. It's really more a snapshot of selected topics. But I do want to mention IDAST. What is it and why do we need it? The pressure of time that we all feel, and the impact of antimicrobial resistance and the need for antibiotic stewardship. And as we go through the talk, please keep in mind this is all focused on how can we, as clinical microbiologists, help doctors provide the very best care for their patients, because I know microbiologists, and I know that that's what you want to do. That's why you come to work every day. So, talking to doctors. How many of you just love talking to doctors? I'm not seeing any friends out there. Why is that? All right, let me tell you about doctors. We are passionate about providing the best care for our patients. I don't care how cynical, how jaded a doctor is, deep in their heart, they really want to help people, because you do not get through 4 years of medical school and a primary care residency unless you have that in your heart. We are data-driven. In God we trust, all others show data. We are trained to see the exceptions in patterns. And this serves us very well when we're sitting in front of a patient and trying to make a diagnosis. In our personal interactions, it's not so good. And we often come off as negative and critical, when in fact we're just honing in on what's not right, because that's what we do for most of the time that we're awake. We also, as I'm sure you're aware, have a very high level of responsibility. We must make complex, life-impacting decisions in the absence of complete information virtually every minute while we're at work. And that is a heavy responsibility, and it leads to a great deal of stress. And increasing the stress is these people that want us to meet performance measures, the ever-present threat of malpractice, and the need to contain costs. So that's my world. Above all else, do no harm. That's from the Hippocratic Oath, and the older I get, the more experienced I get, the more I understand the wisdom of that directive. So, talking to microbiologists, in my job at bioMérieux, I have the opportunity to talk to a microbiologist. I also get calls from our various reps and our... our reps and the customer service people, they call me up. So these are some things that I have personally heard in the last 3 months. Doctors never even look at the ID-AST report. Results don't have any impact on patient care because the patients are already treated by the time they come out. Is this resonating with anybody? Do I have any friends out here? Okay. Why should I rush to do rapid reporting? The doctor doesn't want to know the results at 8 p.m. on the second shift. Doctors don't change therapy when the ID-AST results are available. They just keep them on the same drug. How many friends do I have out there? You guys heard this? Do you feel this? Doctors don't have a clue about MICs. They only look at S and R, and they never know what to do with an I. How many friends do I have? All right. And my personal favorite, the doctor is asking, which drug is the best choice to treat my patient? The one with the lowest number? So as we go through my talk, I will ask you to ponder these questions. Do rapid results from the microbiology lab really mean anything? Do they matter? Is it necessary to know the MIC, or is S, I, and R enough? And do doctors ever actually really use the results from all the work that you do? So think about this, and at the end, we'll come back to it. So thinking about how doctors approach patients. The initial approach to a patient that appears to be infected, the so-called undifferentiated patient, meaning they don't yet have a diagnosis, coming in with signs and symptoms of infection. And the doctor must quickly determine the etiology, or the diagnosis, because that drives therapy, and it also drives what you do with the patient. Do you put them in the ICU, or can they go home with their family? In order to get to etiology, we use all the diagnostic data we have at any point in time. And when you're first seeing the patient, it's generally the history and physical, any radiology results you can get quickly, and any laboratory tests you can get quickly. You also have to assess the severity of the patient's infection, because that's going to impact your therapy choice, and it's going to impact your disposition. Do they go to the ICU? Do they go home? So when you're thinking about, okay, what therapy am I going to give this patient? What antibiotic Am I going to start empirically because I don't know for sure? I don't have any IDAST results back. The decision really comes down to, or the goal is really to maximize the activity against the most likely pathogens at the most likely site of infection. How do I know that? A lot of it is based on the antibiogram data that you provide to me. So I kind of have a feel for, you know, the recent past. I'm seeing a lot of this organism, and it's got this susceptibility pattern. I use that information. I've internalized it, or I carry it around in a card, and that's what I use to pull up, okay, I have a choice of 5 empiric antibiotics. I'm going to pick this one. I also have to think about minimizing harm to the patient, toxic results, or I also want to make sure that I minimize emergence of resistance by choosing the right drug at the right dose. Okay? So these wonder drugs that we have, why don't they always work to cure the infections? Especially when we have the susceptibility result. It says it's S. Why is my patient not doing better? Well, it's really a very complex puzzle. There's host factors, such as the patient's immune status. That's a big one. What underlying diseases do they have? Then there's a site of infection. The same pathogen in the central nervous system is going to be a different type of infection than if it's present in the lung. The properties of the antimicrobials. All of these different drugs act a little differently. And finally, the pathogen itself. We all know that E. coli acts differently than Staph aureus, right? Because they have different virulence factors, different resistance patterns. The part on your left belongs to the doctor. That's the history and physical. The properties of the antimicrobial, that also belongs to the doctor. That's basic pharmacology that we learn in medical school. But this other part, that's a partnership between you and the physician. And the micro lab, the doctor can't do it without you. Let me say that again. The doctor cannot take care of his patient optimally without this piece. It is vital. So before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about pharmacology, so that you can understand what a lot of doctors don't understand, because it's a bullet point on one slide on one day of 4 years of medical school. And I have a little bit of passion about this, because I think that as physicians, we do not understand this as well as we should, and we need to take responsibility for that. So these are some basic tenets of pharmacology. You may have heard bacteriostatic. A static drug is one that inhibits the growth and replication. It sort of stuns the organism, freezes it. And it relies heavily on the immune system to come in and wipe it out. Bactericidal actually kills the organism. It either interferes with the cell wall or the cell membrane or some vital function of the organism, like DNA replication. No DNA, no organism. When you treat a patient with a cidal drug, you still need some effect of the immune system, but much less. Complicating it further, you can't just put all the antimicrobials into one basket or the other. Concentration makes a difference. So some antimicrobials may be bacteriostatic at low concentrations, but bactericidal at higher concentrations. And in general, when you're selecting an antibiotic to treat a patient with an infection, you prefer to pick one that's bactericidal. I mean, that makes sense, right? You just prefer one that's going to really go in and clean up that infection. Especially if you're dealing with an immuno-impaired patient, because that patient doesn't have the backup of the immune system to come in and get rid of those bugs. PK/PD. Has anybody here ever heard that? PK/PD? Right. I can tell you I have personally sat through 50 lectures on this topic, and my eyes always glaze over. So please bear with me. I'm not going to make your eyes glaze over. Pharmacokinetics, that describes all the ways that the human body manipulates a drug, including absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion. And those are basic things that when you develop a new drug, you investigate and you provide information on how the body handles this particular drug in the drug package insert. Pharmacodynamics describes the relationship between the drug exposure in the human and the drug effect, or the interplay of the biochemical and physiologic effects of the drug and its mechanism of action on the pathogen. Because remember, treatment of an infection involves the interaction of a drug on two separate, discrete biologic systems, the host and the pathogen. An anti-infective must pass through the host to get to the site of the infection. And along the way, that drug acts upon the human, hopefully in a minimal way, to cause minimal toxicity, and the body acts on the drug, hopefully in a minimal way, so that the drug maintains its activity. Finally, once the drug gets to the site of infection, the ability of the drug to actually exert its effect on the pathogen depends on the concentration of the drug after it's made its journey through the human body, arrived at the target tissue, how much of it from what you gave in the bottle is still there. And this just kind of shows it graphically. You know, you give a drug, and you can measure the concentration in the serum. It's harder to measure the concentration in the kidney or the lung or the brain. Easier to measure it in the serum. Then you look at the side that says host, you look at the side that says pathogen. And that sort of describes what happens when you give an antibiotic for an infection. This is a cartoon of conceptually what you can measure on any drug. Basically, a concentration curve over time. So on the y-axis, you see the drug concentration. On the x-axis, you see time. And this refers to the three basic pharmacodynamic parameters. Time above a MIC, the time that the drug is above the concentration, the MIC, of that particular pathogen. The area under the curve, the area under that little curve, and its relationship to the MIC. And finally, the peak, the highest level that the drug achieves, and its relationship to the MIC. And different classes of drug, their pharmacodynamics can be described using these different parameters. And anybody that's interested in a more in-depth lecture on that, I mean, there's volumes written. That was a snapshot so your eyes wouldn't glaze over. So back to my question. Antibiotics, why do they sometimes fail, especially when I know it's an S? Well, what really is the value of antimicrobial susceptibility testing? You ever ask that question? You ever wonder? It's to help today's patients, okay? To provide guidance to the physician in selection of the antimicrobial therapy for this patient's isolates today, with the expectation of optimizing the outcome for that patient. It is also to help tomorrow's patient, because as I said, that antibiogram that you are building helps me when I see another patient sitting in front of me to make a decision about which empiric therapy to choose. It also helps next year's patient and next decade's patient, because the pharma companies use all this data to say, lots of gram-negative rod resistance problems. I think I'll go off and discover the next wonder drug for gram-negatives. From my lips to God's ears, I hope. So what is an MIC? Minimum inhibitory concentration. It is the lowest concentration of an antibiotic that inhibits visible growth of a bacterial isolate, and it is a measure of in vitro potency. It is a variable number, as you probably know, and it depends on the method used. That's why we need reference methodology. It depends on the antibiotic, it depends on the species, it depends on the particular pathogen isolate, it depends on the day. You take the same organism, same drug, run it tomorrow, it may be slightly different. These are biologic systems, so they are going to have some variance. But MICs in and of themselves have very little clinical relevance until they are interpreted in the context of the drug, organism, and host properties, which is PK/PD. We need breakpoints. They help us interpret the MIC value. But the optimization of therapy requires more than just S, I, and R, as I am going to demonstrate to you, I hope. So how are these breakpoints set? Do you guys know? I can tell you that you use a series of information: population distribution, PK/PD parameters, known resistant mechanisms, and then how does the drug do in treating real patients. And there's something called the 90-60 rule, which one of my friends coined, which basically says if an organism is called susceptible, infection should respond at least 90% of the time. If an organism is called resistant, then the infection should respond less than 60% of the time. And you're wondering why it's not 100% and not a 0%. And that's because of all those other factors, especially the host factors. So who sets these breakpoints? Is it the FDA, CLSI, UCAS, which is an organization in Europe? Anybody who wants to? We are probably all aware that the FDA is the Food and Drug Administration, and this is a federal agency that was literally created by an act of Congress, and if you want them to change how they do things, often you have to have an act of Congress. Ask me how I know. Now, their responsibilities are vast, but one of the things that they do is they approve drugs and devices for sale in the U.S., and that includes the diagnostic devices like a Vitic-2 or an e-test. And they, in order to do that, they review data that is submitted from the pharmaceutical companies. If the pharmaceutical companies want to sell their drug, it's got to be approved. They've got to send in their data. And as part of that review, the FDA sets breakpoints and puts it in the drug package insert. There is currently no systematic way for the FDA to look back at drugs they've approved and say, emergence of resistance. This drug no longer really, ampicillin no longer works really well against E. coli. Maybe we should change the breakpoints. Maybe we should change a package insert. But the FDA does have the authority, and they do sometimes use it, to command pharmaceutical companies to submit data for updates. And they can change the package insert if they want, if there are data to support it. The CLSI, on the other hand, formerly known as NCCLS, is a consensus organization made up mainly of volunteers from academics, practice, both microbiology and physicians, as well as industry. And among their other responsibilities, they establish reference methodology, which we really need, and they also set susceptibility breakpoints. Now, they rely on the pharma companies to voluntarily submit their data, and the pharmaceutical companies generally only submit a slice of their data, not everything that went to the FDA, because it becomes public. And they request this data on new drugs so that the CLSI can set breakpoints, and they also request it on marketed drugs so that they can go back and fiddle with the breakpoints. Now, susceptibility breakpoints are published every year in M100. How many of you have seen that publication from CLSI? It's an attempt to update susceptibility breakpoints in response to changing susceptibility patterns over time and newly available clinical data. The result, however, is that the CLSI breakpoints have been updated more often than those of the FDA, and they often are in conflict. So, from the point of view of my company, we make Vitic-2 and e-test. Who sets breakpoints? And for us, it's the FDA. So we are required by law to follow the FDA-approved breakpoints. So what do we do when the CLSI breakpoints and the FDA breakpoints aren't the same? I can tell you that there is now great interest in the FDA and the CLSI both in working together to harmonize their breakpoints or to at least prevent discrepancies. The CLSI has agreed that they will not publish discrepant or discordant breakpoints for at least 2 years after a drug is approved. The FDA has also started down the path of thinking how they could legally use CLSI to help them talk to pharma about coming back and showing data potentially to change the breakpoints. And if you're interested, there on the FDA website is this guidance document that you can read. It is only a guidance document, and generally it takes a while before it becomes a real guidance. I'm sorry, it's only a draft, and it does take a while before it becomes an actual guidance. So again, I come back to this question, why do our antibiotics sometimes fail? Well, to state the obvious, sometimes the therapy is just not adequate. Now, it seems obvious, but people went out and did studies. And you see that the yellow here is adequate therapy, and the pink is inadequate therapy, and on the y-axis you have the percent of people who died. And interestingly, the pink columns are higher than the yellow columns. So if you don't give adequate therapy, patients die. Makes sense. But you can also impact the effectiveness of an antimicrobial because you start it too late. There's a delay in getting the right antibiotic on board. And I'm going to just show you these studies. This is several different studies, and they're in your handout. But this is for Pseudomonas aeruginosa bloodstream infections. And you notice that at a breakpoint of about 52 hours, those columns are a lot higher. And again, on the y-axis is 30-day mortality. Here is information for candida infections, serious systemic candida infections. In one study, the one on your left, that actually demonstrated a marked difference at 24 hours. And the one on the right was more in line with the previous study for Pseudomonas at about 2 days. And here it is for Staph aureus, bloodstream infections. And again, we're looking at a difference in patients who get adequate therapy in the first 2 days versus patients in which the adequate therapy is started later. And this is, again, in patient survival. It also has an impact on how long the patient has to stay in the hospital. Anybody here ever been a hospital patient? Anybody have relatives who've been hospitalized patients? I mean, it is not fun being in the hospital. It is also dangerous. And it's also costly. So for all those reasons, we like to get our patients out of the hospital as quickly as possible. If we don't get them started on antibiotics, the correct antibiotics, they may stay in the hospital an extra week. Not fun. Sometimes the breakpoints are wrong. We do our best to set good breakpoints, but data keeps coming in. Now, this is a paper from 2006 out of Clinical Infectious Diseases, and on the y-axis you see failure, and on the x-axis you see MICs, and this is for Staph aureus, for MRSA, patients treated with vancomycin. And really what this shows is, as the MIC goes up, the percentage of patients with a failure also goes up. These are recent data just published this month in AAC, and it shows something similar, different group of patients. And basically it said if the MIC for vancomycin is greater than or equal to 1.5, there is a huge difference in how well the patients do. And that's the orange box, and you see the high percent failure rate. In that study, not only was the failure rate different, but the length of stay, again, was about a week longer for patients that had an MRSA with a vancomycin MIC greater than or equal to 1.5 who were treated with vancomycin. They also frequently had to be switched to another antibiotic. And you're wondering, all right, how often does this happen? Well, these are the data from that study, and basically 72% of the patients in that study had a vancomycin MIC of 1.5 or greater. How many of you report out a vancomycin MIC of 1.5? I see one or two. Well, how do you do that? Actually, I forgot to say this. The question is it time to change the breakpoint? And the answer is maybe. But there really are few alternative therapies for MRSA infections. We have daptomycin, which doesn't work if it's a pneumonia. We have linazolide, which some people consider to be a static drug. We may have ceftobiprole if it ever gets approved by the FDA. But really what we need to know is that MIC, and how do you get to that 1.5? And not to be too commercial, but e-test is the way to go. It's a simple test, but very sophisticated. The method is similar to Kirby Bauer, but it gives you oh so much more information because it gives you an MIC and it gives you the opportunity to look between the doubling dilutions. So for serious MRSA infections, probably you need to do this test. So what are some other reasons why antimicrobials fail? Well, sometimes we get the dose wrong. Here's an example. Fluconazole. Wonderful drug, still works after all these years, relatively inexpensive, available in IV and a PO. And you can dose fluconazole over a range of doses, low, high. Obviously, if the higher the dose, the more likely an adverse event. So you like to get it right. Remember that scale. And in order to do that, you really need to know the MIC, because in this graph, you can see that to the right of the red line, there's a lot of black boxes. Those patients didn't do well. Those are the ones that got a lower dose relative to their MIC. The ones on the left did better because they got a higher dose relative to their MIC. So basically, a dose divided by MIC ratio of greater than 50 was associated with a 67% therapeutic success versus less than 50, 90% of those patients failed. It's a big difference. So in order to maximize, get the right dose into this patient, not only do I need to know that it's candida, not only do I need to know that it's susceptible to fluconazole, I also need to know the actual MIC number so that I can calculate the right dose for my patient. And there have been studies done that demonstrate that the most effective way to treat a patient with candidiasis is with culture-based fluconazole data, and that includes knowing the MIC. And this just points out the relative cost of the new antifungals. And you'll see that caspofungin is about twice the cost of IV fluconazole. Another reason that we fail in treating our patients is that there's no active drug. Now, I'm old enough to remember when MRSA first came along. Okay, I was a child, and my mother was working in the microbiology lab, but I do remember it. And I worry, because I know these microbes, they're smarter than we are. And when you have a doubling time of 20 minutes, there's no way to fight that, right? I mean, it's just they're gonna outsmart us. So obviously, if you have a resistant pathogen that you're trying to treat, your chances of successfully treating that go way down. And that's just what's shown here again. Inappropriate treatment, the likelihood of that on the y-axis, much higher for organisms that have resistance. This is in your handout. It's basically to say antimicrobial resistance is a problem. I mean, Herb mentioned climate change. I think this is probably as big, if not bigger. And this just points out that the more antibiotics you're exposed to, the more likely is that you are going to have a resistant organism. And when you have a resistant organism, your chances of getting inadequate therapy or getting adequate therapy in that two-day window go way down. So, there is a relationship between antibiotic exposure, antibiotic resistance that circles back on itself. And the question is, doctors know this. Why don't we just stop prescribing? Why don't we just stop over-prescribing antibiotics? Well, I don't know how to do that. I know I should, but I don't know how. I know that antibiotics are a resource, and I know they have to be husbanded, and I know I have to change my behavior, but I just don't know how. There is a tremendous pressure to get information quickly, because I know that I have got to get the right drug at the right dose into my patient, or they're not going to do well. And I also know I can't overprescribe antibiotics or there won't be any left, and I'm feeling a lot of pressure. So how do we put this all together to facilitate excellent patient care? What should happen, what does happen, and how can we make those be more similar? Again, back to how do you think about a patient when you first see them. You know, somebody comes in and they're sick. They could have anything. You start to narrow it down. You know, what are their signs and symptoms? What are the possible pathogens? And it's sort of a broad group. And so in the first hour or two, you're dealing with empiric antibiotics. And as you get more and more information, ideally, you modify or you discontinue antibiotics or you streamline or you de-escalate antibiotic therapy, especially once you know the name of the organism and the susceptibility. Now, here's an example of how I would approach this. I have a patient with a candida infection, I'm pretty sure. And I think that they probably have a susceptible fluconazole, susceptible infection. I would start them on fluconazole because it's a good drug. It works. I can give it IV or oral. I can, you know, ramp up the dose if I need to, and it's inexpensive. And it's not particularly toxic. On the other hand, if my patient is marginal and I'm not sure, empirically I put him on echinocandin or amphotericin. But then my micro lab calls me in a day or two because they have the Vitek 2 fluconazole card, and they say, "Doctor, your patient has fluconazole susceptible candida albicans." And I say, "Wonderful." And then what do I ask? What's the MIC? Because I want to maximize the dose, and so I do that. And then in a few days, my patient's doing better. I switch them to oral fluconazole, and I send them home. And for a patient that is a chemotherapy patient and they're in and out of the hospital all the time and they have cancer and that's a terminal disease, to send them home a week early is a gift. On the other hand, if you tell me this is a candida glabrata and the MIC is high, I know I can't put them on fluconazole. I need to leave them on an echinocandin. So you've given me information to treat my patient. And it's really the fear of candida glabrata that drives a lot of the use of the echinocandins, which is exactly what you should do in an empiric setting. But after a day or two, you should have access to the fluconazole AST result, and you should make a change. Because the knowledge of that fluconazole susceptibility provides you the opportunity to decrease costs, decrease length of hospital stay, and decrease potential toxicity. But it's that susceptibility data that does it. It's what you guys provide. So what really happens? Well, I think doctors are pretty good at prescribing empiric antibiotics. Moving to the next step, however, a lot of times this just never happens, unfortunately. Why is that? Part of it is the timing. You know, by the time that I get the results, my patient's doing better, and I'm like, well, I might as well just leave them alone. Because you may tell me there's no pathogenic organisms isolated, but that is not the same thing as no pathogenic organisms present. May not be present in the sample, but they may still be in the patient. You tell me that you have isolated pathogenic organism A. And that is not the same thing as telling me that that pathogenic organism A is causing my patient's infection. So I have to balance what you tell me with how my patient is doing. It's my job as a physician to do that. And that is the art in the practice of medicine. And I will always tend on the side of conservatism, and and the effect of that is to overprescribe broad-spectrum antibiotics. And I also ask you to keep in mind the clinical context in which your results are delivered. So, for example, you call me up and you say, Dr. Fowler, your patient is growing gram-positive cocci clusters out of blood culture. And I say to you, okay, thanks, bye. And you think, she doesn't care. I put in all this work. I stayed, you know, late. I didn't go to my lunch to get her on the phone, and she just doesn't care. But that's actually not the case. Remember what I told you about we're trained to see the discordant? You have just, this is a patient that I admitted from the ER with cellulitis. I thought they had Staph aureus. You've just confirmed it. They're on vancomycin. They're doing fine. So in my mind, it's like, great, thank you. But I don't always say that. This patient's doing well. And again, if I were smart, I'm going to want to know the AST tomorrow or the next day, because I want to know if I can switch them to a beta-lactam, because I know those drugs are better if it's MSSA. And if it's MRSA, I want to know if it's 1.5 or above, because then I got to start thinking about other drugs. But my patient's doing well, and I had the right diagnosis, and all is right with the world. So you call me up, and you say, Dr. Fowler, your patient is growing gram-positive cocci out of their blood culture. And I go, what? Are you sure? Because this is a patient that I thought had urosepsis, and they're on Levaquin, and they're doing well, and I'm about to send them out the door, and you're telling me they have gram-positive cocci and clusters in their blood? This is discordant. Now, I'm looking at my patient. She's sitting up. She's smiling. She's putting on lipstick. Probably she does not have Staph aureus in her bloodstream, but I need to know. So this is a case where if you could tell me right away it's coag-negative Staph, I'm like, all right, fine, contaminant. If you could tell me that right now, I'd be very happy. But I understand it may take a few hours to a few days to tell me that. But I'm probably not going to alter my therapy of my patient. So you call me up, and you say, Dr. Fowler, your patient is growing gram-positive cocci clusters out of their blood culture. And I go, really? Are you sure? Because this is a patient that I thought had urosepsis, and I have them on Levaquin. But they're not sitting up, and they're not putting on lipstick. They're actually not looking so good. And I'm thinking, do I have the right diagnosis? So I say to you, what's their urine culture growing? Because I know they had white cells. They had tenderness back here. I'm pretty sure she has pylo. And you tell me it looks like Staph aureus out of the urine. And I'm going, oh, dear. This patient has Staph aureus pyelonephritis. Not a good thing. And I have them on Levaquin, good drug, but not really for Staph aureus. So I am going to change the therapy on this patient. I am going to put them on something else. And I'm going to want to know what the ID, what the identification of that organism and the AST is. I'm going to want to know that. You call me up and you say, Dr. Fowler, your patient has gram-positive cocci and clusters out of their blood culture. And I go, really? Great. Thank you. This is a patient that I admitted from the ER with community-acquired pneumonia. I put him on Levaquin and ceftriaxone, which is the standard therapy. This patient isn't doing well. As a matter of fact, I'm taking her to the unit, and I'm going to intubate her because she's crashing. And I am so grateful that I know I missed the diagnosis. This patient probably has community-associated MRSA pneumonia, and her chances of survival are really low. And I have missed that window of opportunity to treat her with the right antibiotic. So I am in a panic, and I am very grateful to you for telling me this result. And I will hound you to find out the susceptibility, because I have to know. I mean, I already made the leap. This is Staph aureus. I missed it. I need to know the AST. So please, when you get that little thanks, bye, don't ever think that those results don't mean something, because they do. And I will come back and I will look for the follow-up results the next day, and the faster you can get it to me, the better my patient is going to do. So what can the microbiology lab do to reduce this uncertainty? You can provide me accurate results as quickly as possible. You can take on new tasks, and I understand you can't do everything, and you have to sort of, you know, pick and choose. And an example is molecular detection. I think, as Dr. Hall mentioned, molecular detection is great, but we still need growth-based microbiology. We are not yet to the point of Star Trek with the medical tricorder that you wave over the patient and you go, ah, Staph aureus, sensitive to. I look forward to that day, probably not in my lifetime. You can also establish a dialogue about new tests or new ways of reporting with your physicians. And an example is rapid reporting. Now, I agree with you. For physicians that have an office-based practice, who put patients in the hospital, they come in the morning, they make rounds, they tuck their patients in, and they go to their office and they have a full day, one patient after another. Their brain is on those patients in their office, and as long as the nursing staff is not calling saying, oh, doctor, your patient doesn't look so good, they don't want to think about that patient. So if you call them up, even at 4 or 5 in the afternoon and say, you know that gram-positive cocci I told you about yesterday? It's a Staph aureus. You're right, they don't really care. But, and I asked my friends this, and they all concur, they may not care at 4 or 5 or 6 o'clock at night, but if those results are in the computer or on the chart at 6 or 6:30 in the morning when they make their rounds, priceless. They have the patient, they have the results. They can make a decision, they can tuck the patient in and go to the next patient. They don't have to, like, see all their patients, then go to the micro lab to get the results that have come out around 10 o'clock. So although you may perceive that that second shift work isn't of value, to the physician who comes in the next morning and has everything he or she needs to make a decision, priceless. Also, many of you may work in institutions where there are hospitalists, and these are doctors, and all they do is the hospital work. And they work on shifts, and they're supposed to be alert and oriented at all times, and their job is to take care of patients. So if you send out results at 2 in the morning, they actually might look at them, and they might actually do something with them. So I think more and more that's a wave of the future. So getting those results out as soon as you can actually does impact patient care. The other thing, in addition to providing the accurate results, is that institutional antibiogram I talked about. That's priceless. I don't know how we could take care of patients as well as we do without that information. So thank you for doing that. And finally, we have to work towards helping physicians understand the value of an MIC. And I don't know that that's your job. It probably isn't. But there might be something that we as microbiologists can do to help physicians quickly assess the relationship of the MIC to the breakpoint. And this is just one thing. This came from the AV BioDisc website. And it provides a graphic presentation of MIC data relative to the susceptibility breakpoint. Because the drug you really want to pick, all other things being equal, is the one that's the farthest from the susceptibility breakpoint. So, in conclusion, do rapid results from the microbiology laboratory really matter? Absolutely. They truly have an impact on mortality, length of stay, and cost. Is it necessary to know the MIC? Absolutely. It facilitates selection of the right drug at the right dose. Do doctors ever use the data from microbiology laboratories to make treatment decisions? Absolutely. All the time. But we could do better. We could make better use of the information you provide. So I thank you very much for your attention, and however much time we have, I can answer questions.